Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, first published in 1960, tells the story of a small town in the South and a white lawyer, Atticus Finch, defending a black man, Tom Robinson, accused of rape. In a country heating up over civil rights, the book was an instant success. America today is a different place beyond the civil rights era and, some say, post-racial. And yet, To Kill a Mockingbird endures with over 30 million copies sold and a firm place on reading lists in high schools across the nation and in many hearts. This hour on Point, To Kill a Mockingbird at 50. You can join the conversation. Why has Harper Lee's story of Atticus, Scout, and Boo Radley had such staying power? Has it cast its spell on you? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Came out in 1960, the beginning of the 1962 film To Kill a Mockingbird opens with Scout as an adult reflecting back on her childhood home.
Macon was a tired old town, even in 1932 when I first knew it. Somehow it was hotter then. Men's stiff collars wilted by 9 in the morning. Ladies bathed before noon, after their 3 o'clock naps. And by nightfall, we're like soft tea cakes with frostings of sweat and sweet talcum. A day was 24 hours long, but it seemed longer. There was no hurry, for there was nowhere to go, nothing to buy, no money to buy it with. Although Macon County had recently been told that it had nothing to fear but fear itself.
To Kill a Mockingbird, in the beginning of the 1962 movie, all heat and summer languor there, but things heat up politically, racially, in a hurry. We're looking back on To Kill a Mockingbird at 50. We've got a wonderful crew with us today to think about the book, including in a few minutes a young African-American teacher who now teaches To Kill a Mockingbird in Tennessee. But first, joining me from Berkeley, California, is Claudia Durst Johnson. She is professor emeritus at the University of Alabama, where she chaired the English department. She's author of To Kill a Mockingbird, Threatening Boundaries, a seminal work of scholarship on the novel. And she's a friend of Harper Lee, who just might be listening today. Claudia Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
And with us from Fairhope, Alabama, is Rick Bragg, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and professor of writing at the University of Alabama. He received the 2009 Harper Lee Award for Distinguished Alabama Writer from the Alabama Writers Forum. He's author most recently of The Most They Ever Had and the memoir The Prince of Frogtown. Rick Bragg, welcome back to On Point.
It's a great pleasure.
It's great to have you with us. Rick, you've been out at some of these dues going on around the To Kill a Mockingbird's anniversary. How are people in Alabama looking back on the book in this 50th anniversary year of its publication?
Well, I think a lot of us are just proud of the book. We're proud it came from our dirt. We're proud that it had the impact on people's lives that it had, and it came from here. It came from one of the state's writers, and yeah, there's a little revisionist history going on. You see a lot of people celebrating the book that might not have necessarily agreed with its message when it first came out, but it's been fun to watch. There have been an awful lot of people remembering the first time they ever read it.
Mm-hmm.
And that has spurred some great conversations.
Claudia Durst Johnson, remind us, Rick Bragg says it came, speaking in a literary way, out of the Alabama dirt here. Remind us of Harper Lee's, Nell Lee's, I guess Harper's her middle name, young life, and how, indeed, much of the setting of To Kill a Mockingbird seems to parallel that setting.
Yes, well, of course, Monroeville, Alabama, is the setting of the novel, and if you've ever met Harper Lee, you know she's Scout, or Scout is Harper Lee.
That's just it, plain as day.
Oh yeah, very strong, full of humor, very sharp, very outspoken. And Nell Lee's father was an attorney and editor of a newspaper in Monroeville. So I we hate to linger on the fact that the novel is autobiographical, but there are autobiographical elements in it. It certainly has the background of the Scottsboro trials, which occurred about the time of the setting of the novel. And we have the civil rights movement, which was gaining steam at the time of the novel's composition, including a number of events in Alabama itself.
And there was Harper Lee, Nell Lee, a tomboy, as a matter of fact, as you say, her dad a lawyer, family house on South Alabama Avenue, not far from the courthouse. And there we've got a childhood that would give a setting to this book. Rick, Claudia reminds us of the Scottsboro trials and the Scottsboro boys. Remind us more fully what was going on there as kind of backdrop to this fictional story.
Well, it was just another, but a real-life case where you had a young man accused of an awful crime that and race took over and ran with it, and facts came to matter less than emotion. And there were a lot of cases like that in this state and outside the state. And what Harper Lee did was she captured it and boiled it down to a single man and a single injustice so that we could kind of get our minds around it and understand it.
Claudia, did Harper Lee, Nell Lee, did she see herself as a civil rights fighter, advocate, or something else?
That's hard to answer, really. I do know that when she was a student at the University of Alabama, she worked for, was either editor of or reporter for a satirical university publication run by the students. And she was very involved in voter registration in that journal. So she was certainly aware of what was going on, though I don't really see her as acting as an activist.
I mean, she was also editor of the college humor magazine, the Rammer Jammer.
Yeah, that's what I meant to
right. And also, ultimately,
say.
A law school dropout. So she's got some of that training in addition to her father's career. Why do you think this book went so deep with the American reading public, Claudia? What was it about this telling of the South and moral struggles there that caught the country's attention so fully? Why this one?
Well, people like Jim Carroll have and other Southerners have said, you know, this was an underside of their own society, which had never fully come to the surface, or the meaning of what they were seeing every day in terms of race and class and gender had never really hit them until they read the novel. I think a lot of the novel's force comes from the character of Atticus.
Mm-hmm.
Our need for a hero, a real hero.
Yeah.
And we see it most particularly in the novel's popularity among lawyers. It's a rare lawyer that doesn't tell you he went into law or she went into law because of this novel.
Because of Atticus Finch, that image, that icon.
Because of Atticus, yes. And I think Oh, go ahead.
Well, just Rick, I just want to put to you, I mean, is it really possible? This came out in 1960. I'm not sure how long it took her to write this, but is it really possible that it was still a revelation to Southern readers, what they found between these pages?
Well, let me put it this way. When I was a child in Alabama in the 1960s, my mother had taught me that you don't treat people differently because of color. So, you know, that...
It needed that teaching still.
Mm-hmm. In my mind.
Mm-hmm.
What Harper Lee did was this. She made us understand it in a broader context in our society. We have this cold remedy down here in the Deep South where you take white whiskey or bourbon if you're the upper classes.
Mm-hmm.
But you take whiskey and you pour it in a glass and you hand it to a child and he takes a sip or two, and it doesn't do much for the cold, but it makes the child sleep.
Right.
It doesn't really work that good unless you can get it down. And what my grandmother would do would be to break a piece of peppermint candy. She'd put it in a sock and bang it against the side of a bedpost.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird at 50 and what it has meant to generations by now of Americans, with Claudia Durst Johnson, Professor Emeritus, longtime chairman of the English Department at the University of Alabama. She wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, Threatening Boundaries, and by Rick Bragg, of course, great writer of the South, the most they ever had, the Prince of Frogtown, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and professor of writing himself at the University of Alabama. He joins us from Fairhope, Alabama. And Rick, you were right in the middle of a kind of metaphor here about maybe To Kill a Mockingbird as that white whiskey that your grandmother gave you with peppermint in a sock.
Yeah, what you would do is you would, to get the medicine down, you'd have to sweeten it. So she would put this peppermint, put it in the sock, bang it on whatever hard surface, break it up, and then sprinkle it in the whiskey. And then you could get it down. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what the beautiful story. I think people forget how beautifully written that book is and how compelling and powerful the writing is. And so the story made the message go down. I think if it had not been written so well and had not been written so beautifully, then it would not have had the impact that it had. Obviously, it would have never been consumed by so many people.
Maybe there's the peppermint in the whiskey. Claudia Johnson, how about it? I mean, there's a tension there, I suppose, because what's being described was anything but lovely. But at the same time, there's such a palpable love for the region and all its idiosyncrasies and its daily life. You can even read it as a kind of sentimental novel, even as it goes to issues of race and justice.
Well, yes, I think I agree with Rick. The writing in some, especially in some key episodes, is so powerful they can bring tears to your eyes. Her scouts comments on what it means to her when her teacher threatens to keep her from reading, what reading means to her. The scene as Atticus is walking out of the courthouse,
mm-hmm.
Scout is told to stand up, Miss Jean Louise, your father's passing. And the end of the novel with
Scout. She's told this by African Americans in the audience there, who showing respect to her father, who's
right.
Failed in his defense, but nevertheless is seen as having made a noble effort.
Oh, yes. Yes. And it's the humor of the novel, too. It's not heavy. It's not a soap opera. It's a very serious work that also has in it a lot of humor.
Let's hear a little bit more from the film. Here's a little bit in the courthouse. This is Scout, her brother Jem, their friend Dill, who everybody says is modeled on Truman Capote. They go to spy on who was a neighbor during Harper Lee's youth. They go to spy on their father Atticus, who's preparing for trial to defend a black man accused of rape.
I say your dad ain't a colored man. The colored man.
Shh.
The colored man looks to me like he's crying.
And I see him.
I wonder what he's done to cry about.
What's going on?
There's a whole lot of men sitting together on one side, and one man keeps pointing at the colored man and yelling, taking the colored man away.
Where's Atticus?
I can't see your daddy now either.
I can't see your daddy now either. And then here, Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, he won an Oscar. He's explaining here to Scout why he's taken on this difficult case.
There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town. I couldn't even tell you or Jem not to do something again. You're going to hear some ugly talk about this in school. But I want you to promise me one thing. That you won't get into fights over it. No matter what they say to you.
Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. Claudia Durst Johnson and Rick Bragg are with us. In just a moment, we're going to go to a teacher who's teaching this book now. In the South, let's get a call first. Kevin in Savannah, Georgia. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Pretty well. Have you read it? What do you make of it?
Well, I read the book like most Americans, mm-hmm. you know, when I was in high school. And then a few years ago, it's been 15 years, and I read it again. And while I agree that the book is very beautifully written, I couldn't help but notice sort of a classist nature to the book, where the hero is this privileged, rich, white lawyer, and the bad guys in the book are this, poor, underprivileged white family.
Yeah.
And while I certainly don't defend or agree with, the attitude and the ignorance of that family, I couldn't help but notice that we make the hero in that story a person who has sort of created the paradigm in which it takes place.
Of that class. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. So I guess my question is, how true to what was going on is the story? Is Atticus, is he par for the course? Does the family... Do they deserve, what they get, or are they victims too?
It's such a great question, Kevin, and it's right in Rick Bragg's wheelhouse. He's been thinking a lot about these issues of how tensions of race and class run through the book. Rick, I wish you'd take up Kevin's invitation there.
Sure. Well, I've always said that race is hard, but class is a lot harder in the Deep South. Atticus is a member of a frayed aristocracy, and the Yules, the bad guys, are what folks refer to as white trash, and in a lot of Southern literature, you have the frayed aristocracy coming to the rescue. They've been to college. They read books. They understand the broader world. And the poor rednecks, commit the evils and the wrongdoings. And, of course, that flies in the face of history. In Mississippi, the Sovereignty Commission was not led by pulpwooders and
right. It was it Alabama was, aristocracy in a way.
Right. Well, it's the Mississippi aristocracy.
The Mississippi,
there.
Excuse me.
But you know the the Alabama aristocracy very much created this miserable world of segregation, and it served them. Now, Atticus is one of the good guys. You know, I love this book more than any book I've ever read, except maybe Huckleberry Finn, as far as a moral message goes. But it does present the aristocracy as, and not all of them, of course, you know, the book's more complicated than that.
Sure.
There are there are rich folks in town who very much want to see the wrong thing happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it, that is, you know, kind of a thing that rubs some of us who are from working class Southerners the wrong way. And it's the only thing in the book that I've ever chafed a little bit under, because we were the Yules. You know, we were the, we did not have the mean racism in us, I hope, but we, you know, we would have lived closer to the city dump. Let me put it that way.
And there's a definite perspective here. Here's the moment from the movie where, standing outside the jailhouse, Atticus Finch stands kind of almost alone, where his defendant Tom Robinson is being kept inside. A mob of men with guns confront him, making their intentions quite clear.
You in there, Mr. Finch?
He is. He's asleep. Don't wake him.
You know what we want. Get aside from that door, Mr. Finch.
Walter. I think you ought to turn right around and go back home. Heck, Tate's around here somewhere.
No, he ain't.
Atticus Finch on the watch there in the movie, Gregory Peck of To Kill a Mockingbird. Claudia Durst Johnson, Rick Bragg, please stand by. Joining us right now from Bartlett, Tennessee, and we're very glad to have her, is Catherine Jones. She teaches freshman and sophomore English and creative writing at Bartlett High School. She received the 2009 Outstanding New Teacher of English Award from the Shelby Memphis Council of English Teachers, and it's terrific to have her with us today. Ms. Jones, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Here you are, a young African-American teacher in the year 2010 with the African-American president in the White House, and you're teaching To Kill a Mockingbird to high school students there. How do they take it on board? Are they impressed with it? Does it still get their attention?
Well, dealing with the present generation, there's a detachment, and that detachment is, okay, so what is this book supposed to prove? And what's going on with the present generation is they're accepting of whatever happens. There is no defense. There is no, this is my belief and I'm sticking to that type of situation. So how they take on the novel is just, it's an assignment. So I'm going to read it.
It's an assignment, and for a lot of people, it's become a passion. What about for you? I know you, you know, jumped into the book to prepare for teaching to these classes. So, as a 20-something, with your own background, how did the book strike you?
You know, in listening to the conversation before I joined in, and really just looking back at what I have taken the time to read, it is beautifully written, and it really discusses the human experience that everyone needs to read. And that's one thing about literature. It makes you think. And this novel, it makes me think even about how I'm going to reteach it for my incoming freshmen, because it's just something that we all need to experience, whether it's a part of us, whether we don't think it's a part of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something we need to take in so that we can just understand how people are instead of what they were.
How they are. I want to look at that with you. I wonder about the characterizations. I mean, as you read this as a young African-American today, or as your students, even younger, reading this, mm-hmm. you know, there's been some complaint from the African-American community because you have this older image of the Southern black man, hat in hand, you know, with a little bit of that curled shoulder in front of the white power structure there. Does that annoy you? Does it look just like, well, that was history? How do you take that on board?
It doesn't annoy me. Now, if you were to have asked me when I was their age, the students that I'm teaching, yes, it would have. Mm-hmm. But now that I've experienced life a little more, that just teaches me, or it taught me, that that's the way they were reared. So I have to take that and put it towards what I know now and understand that that was their human experience. And for that to be a human experience, what can it do for me now? It doesn't strike me as, why did they make that character that way? That character needed to be formulated that way so that readers could see that, hey, it's not what we are today. It's what that was. So now we've taken that and we've evolved. So understand that that's history, and you need to embrace it, not necessarily say, well, this is the way I am now. No, mm-hmm. Embrace it and understand that change can occur.
Claudia Johnson, you taught this for years at the University of Alabama to students a bit older than Catherine Jones' students, but can you imagine still teaching it to even younger students in 2010 today with all the changes that have unfolded in this country, Claudia?
Well, let me make a correction in your question. Never taught the novel, and in my 23 years at the University of Alabama, I think it was on one reading list. It was never in the curriculum.
Is that what does that mean?
Wow.
You were in charge. Were you keeping it off the curriculum? Or it wasn't worthy, or what?
I don't laud it over people's reading list. It was never chosen. And if you look around today at higher education, you will find that it is not ever on reading lists for the most part.
Well, in high school, it's right there with Romeo and Juliet and The Great Gatsby and all the rest.
Well, it came to have the curse that Huckleberry Finn had, that it was, quote, a boy's book, a young people's book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also... There's no body of work. There's just one book.
Which,
and that keeps it out of the curriculum in higher education. But the other thing, and this is maybe a mean thing to say, I think literary critics frequently have the feeling that anything that is so popular with the masses can't possibly be great literature. So to go ahead with
because, forgive me, I just assumed you taught it, but I guess I got that wrong.
No, I've just written about
right,
it.
Right.
The matter about Tom Robinson and his supposedly obeisance that is so offensive to many young African-American readers, I'd like to address that, if I may. And that is, it was not just the way things were. It was his survival. It was the only way he could survive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird at 50 and what it has meant by now to generations of Americans. Here's just a bit more from the movie version, Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, giving his summation at the trial and defense of Tom Robinson.
And so, a quiet, humble, respectable Negro who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white peoples. The defendant is not guilty, but somebody in this courtroom is.
And yes, indeed, in Harper Lee's telling, somebody was. Claudia Durst Johnson joins us, professor emeritus at the University of Alabama. Rick Bragg is with us, great writer, author of The Most They Ever Had and The Prince of Frogtown most recently. And Catherine Jones is here from Bartlett, Tennessee. She teaches To Kill a Mockingbird to her students at Bartlett High School outside of Memphis. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Let's just get one from Albuquerque, New Mexico. AJ, you're on the air, AJ.
Good day, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
It was as a small boy that I first saw the movie and then later would read the book. And from the very beginning of the picture with the Universal logo and Elmer Bernstein's evocative, poignant, and beautiful melody playing, I was transported into another world and met characters who would be with me through my life, from Atticus Finch, portrayed by, as you pointed out, Oscar-winning Gregory Peck for that role, to Robert Duvall playing Boo Radley, who never says a word, to Mrs. DuBose, who I don't think in the film, in the screenplay by Horton Foote, it's mentioned, but in the novel, of course, she died owing nothing and no one, which is in itself extraordinary. And the great character actor who didn't make too many films, Frank Overton, as Sheriff Heck Tate,
right,
in a terrific portrayal.
Had you read the book when you first saw it, AJ, or not even?
Not even. No, I was unaware of the story. It would be a few years before I read the novel, and when I did, it was the first book and one of a very, very few books in my life that I was genuinely saddened over when it came to an end. I wished it had just gone on and on.
And was it the narrative power of the story or the moral power of this book that got you, AJ?
Yes.
That's a fair answer. Maybe they can't be disentangled. AJ, thanks for calling. We've got a couple of comments here. Here's one on Facebook from Christopher saying he's in the middle of reading To Kill a Mockingbird for the fourth time right now. And another from Danielle. Gosh, what a book. I was a freshman in high school when I read it. And let me tell you, I was not a very good reader at that time as I had comprehension problems. But I was able to understand this story so clearly, I tore right through it. And then she says, we watched the movie after we read the book, and wow, was Gregory Peck ever handsome. Well, yes, he was. Yes, he was. Claudia, you were saying how there's a kind of prejudice against a book of such popularity, perhaps, but it was taught in the law school.
Taught in the law school. Most of the scholarship on the book appears in law journals. Sociologists have been interested in it. Psychologists have been interested in it, but for some reason, not
the
literary
English department
critics
at the University of Alabama. Catherine Jones, do your students today, and they would be what I suppose 15 years old in that range? Do they see themselves? Do they recognize the struggle, the moral struggle, the struggle over race going on in the book? They must. Do they identify with it, or do they see that as, you know, that was then, and we're in a different era now?
Well, some see it as that was then, this is now, and some actually recognize it because of how well it is written. They can understand the storyline, and they can recall from what they talk with their grandparents about, well, why did this happen? Because their grandparents are of that age bracket where the book was out. So some of them have a relationship with it, and some are just like, okay, well, that's the past. And that's when I was speaking of the detachment.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand that history is important, and it's important to who you are. So when you read it, you have to come to life or come to terms with, this is something that must be experienced.
Well, that's about as close to bringing it fresh to life as you're going to find out there. I know we've got to let you get back to your teaching duties there, Ms. Jones, Catherine Jones, but we're really grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Catherine Jones teaches freshman and sophomore English at Bartlett High School in Bartlett, Tennessee. Let's go to New York, West Seneca, New York, and Susan. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Yes?
Yeah, what do you think, Susan?
Well, my thought was that my son was made to read the book through school, and they supplied the books for them. And I read along with my son because he's not the greatest reader in the world, and I was so taken by the book that I read it out loud to my husband at night. So we went and purchased the book, and we have each since read the book, and we are both totally love the book. We're just enthralled by it. But my son, on the other hand, is like, you know, whatever, as the kids do now. And I really don't think that the children of this generation don't take the book as much as their parents do, because I grew up with knowing all of the racial problems that there were and hearing my parents talk about it, and the N-word was very common in my house as a child. And I remember my daughter coming home and asking me what it meant, and it moved me that she even asked that,
mm-hmm.
because today I had to explain to her how this is such a hateful word, and it's close to being a swear word.
Right.
And it's just such a rude thing to pin on somebody.
She had to ask you what it meant. That's a passage of an era right there.
Isn't it, though?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because when I was a child, it was said as common as the word water.
Wow.
In the house, you know? And she had to ask, and I did in my own mind pat myself on the back for bringing my child up to not know what this meant.
Well, that's some passage of history to report. I appreciate your call, Susan. Rick Bragg, I don't know if you pay attention to even younger readers and how they take this on board versus, you know, the generation that it caught in early or midlife right off. I mean, I wonder if it still has the resonance with the video game, you know, post the millennial generation that it had for so many before.
Well, I think they're just bombarded with trivia. And it's just more complicated. The fact is that one of the reasons that To Kill a Mockingbird held focus and I think held attention was because there was very much a living, breathing cruelty that kind of focused the book, and you know, there were good guys and bad guys and rights and wrongs, and now race is more complicated, you know, culturally words that used to cut like a knife, as the lady just said, now are just part of the vernacular. So I just think that kids find themselves in a more complicated place.
Yeah. No doubt. Let's get a call from Somerville, Massachusetts, and Daniel. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think mention should be made during this discussion about a fairly well-known essay that Malcolm Gladwell wrote in The New Yorker this year, just 3 or 4 months ago.
August of last year, but very recently. Yes, you're right.
Where he basically rips the book apart. Now, I think that Gladwell is kind of an intellectual whippersnapper, you know, kind of just an entrepreneur of ideas, and he's often wrong about things. But he was so bitter and just negative about a book where a rich, intellectually enlightened white man saves the world for the blacks. I personally think that books should be read 50 and 100 and 150 years later and read in the context of their time. So I didn't really agree with this, but I wonder, do you think that this is an opinion that is becoming more and more common among the intellectual classes, at least?
Yeah, Daniel, I'm glad you raised it. We were kind of creeping up to it with Rick Bragg's discussion of class there. But Claudia, Rick, you probably saw this was last August in The New Yorker, and it was a long essay called The Courthouse Ring, as in almost
yes.
Gang, Atticus Finch and the Limits of Southern Liberalism. And Malcolm Gladwell, he says, you know, look, Atticus Finch was one of these guys. Yes, he took up Tom Robinson's case, but he wasn't going to break the china to change the society around him. He took one case, but he lived, you know, relatively comfortably within a larger system that was pretty oppressive, and Gladwell kind of takes him to task for that, to say the least.
Yes, I read the article. It reminded me of an older article written by a lawyer who took Atticus Finch to task for, or said he was not a proper role model
mm-hmm.
for lawyers, as he is often pointed out to be.
Because in that critique, why?
Because he's in the legislature. He's not actively working for desegregation, say.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One of his favorite columnists was a right winger back when. But after that article came out, the man got so many furious letters from lawyers.
Did he stand down?
Yeah. He said he took it back. And he said it had been like criticizing Mother Teresa and Bambi at the same time.
Do not go there. Rick, how about it? Do you fault the character of Atticus Fitch for taking this on as kind of a personal mission instead of being a social firebrand, marching across the bridge, organizing the boycott, changing it all?
Well, I think we all want that to happen. We all want Atticus to not strike a blow for morality, but to take some wire cutters and get that poor man out of the county prison camp. You know, we want him to fix the world, and that's not going to happen. But here's the victory in it. The fact that people, writers and intellectuals or whoever, have created a flesh and blood character of Atticus. You know, they don't see Atticus as a character in a novel. They see him as flesh and blood and alive. Harper Lee created a character so powerful mm-hmm. that people take it personally. And I'll give you an example, and this is in a good way, not mm-hmm. nitpicking or intellectual sniping, but a good way.
Mm-hmm.
Doug Jones, former U.S. Assistant U.S. attorney in Alabama, sent two, with the help of the FBI and many other law enforcement people, sent two old Klansmen to prison for life in the 16th Street Church bombing in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
He did so in part because Atticus Fitch was always in his head. He went against mm-hmm. social bucking to send those mm-hmm. two old killers to prison. And he did so in part because that book and the movie, to be honest, were always in his head. That's pretty powerful as a legacy.
Yeah, I would say so. An inspiration that stuck right there with him when the heat was really on. Melissa, Charleston, South Carolina. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to call in and let everyone know how powerful this book was for me. As a young woman in my 30s in the South, I always heard stories about the issues that took place when my kids or my parents were kids mm-hmm. in the 60s. And until I read this book and really watched the movie, I had a, sort of a disconnect with it. And it really was real for me, and it made a huge impression on me, so much so that when I married years ago, I married a Finch, and we actually named our son Atticus Fitch. So,
so Atticus Fitch lives.
Yes, oh, Atticus well. Michael Fitch. He's 6 years old, and he lives in Charleston, South Carolina.
Well, that's good. Hats off to Atticus Michael Fitch. Melissa, thanks for your call. Claudia, you know Harper Lee. She says not just no, but hell no to interviews. But how, do you have any sense of what satisfaction she's taken over the years for the way this book has left such a mark on so many?
Oh, I think it's been a great boon to her to hear praise of the book and reports like we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have written her and say they read the book every year.
Wow.
And, of course, it's changed so many lives, but she is she's more like the writers at the turn of the century in her connection, in her public connection. She doesn't feel obliged to go on a talk show. She doesn't feel obliged to do interviews when she really would rather not.
She's 84 or so now. How is she doing? Is she still out and about?
I think so. She has some health problems, but she still is bright as she can be, keeps up on politics and that sort of thing. And as I said before, has this rollicking sense of humor. So she's a great person.
Well, we hope Harper Lee's maybe listened a little bit today. That would be terrific. And we're very grateful to each of you. Claudia Durst Johnson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama, was chair there for years of the English department. Ms. Johnson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Rick Bragg, author of The Most They Ever Had and The Prince of Frogtown. Rick, it's always great to have you on. Thank you very much for joining us on the 50th anniversary year of To Kill a Mockingbird. Thank you, Rick.
It was a great pleasure.
We'll go out with a little bit more of the great soundtrack from the film. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.